It's Central Time. I'm Jake Carlisle-Larsen.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about why rural parts of Wisconsin are seeing fewer taverns and what that says about how the way we socialize may be changing.
First, the National Human Trafficking Hotline reported more than 60 cases of trafficking in Wisconsin in 2018. That's down from 91 reported cases in 2017. While there has been a decrease in the number of cases reported, human trafficking remains a big deal in the state.
Trafficking often takes many forms, but can largely go unnoticed and underreported, even by those who are being trafficked themselves. Danielle Melfi joins us now to talk about human trafficking in Wisconsin. She's the Assistant Secretary for the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families and has advised federal agencies on how to advocate for and protect survivors of human trafficking. Danielle, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, and thank you for making the time to talk about this issue.
Sure. So start off by giving us kind of a picture of what human trafficking looks like in general and in Wisconsin, because it may not be what people envision when they think of human trafficking.
Yeah. So human trafficking kind of operates in a few different ways. So at a baseline, it's the use of fraud, force, or coercion to obtain labor or commercial sex. It happens across both men and women, boys and girls of all ages and backgrounds can be victims of trafficking. But often, traffickers target those who are most vulnerable. And that's why it's often one of those hidden in plain sight crimes. We think of runaway and homeless youth, LGBTQ youth, youth in the foster care system, those who have been victims of previous abuse, and youth of color or children with disabilities are disproportionately affected as victims.
You use the phrase hidden in plain sight, and one phrase that I'm guessing you hear a lot in your work is, this sounds like a problem, and I'm glad that this doesn't happen here, but it turns out that this is happening here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about how prevalent this issue is in the states?
Yeah, so with trafficking has been reported in all 72 counties. It happens, I think there's also this myth that it just happens in super urban parts of the state or across the country, but it affects urban, rural, and tribal communities. Trafficking, again, has been reported in all 72 counties. We're still working on collecting better data on this issue. Both the Department of Children and Families and local law enforcement work on this often together. And we have a report from June 2017 through August 2018 where child welfare workers confirmed 99 incidents of child and youth sex trafficking throughout the state. But often it's frequently underreported, and that is just on the child sex trafficking side. Doesn't include adults and doesn't include labor trafficking, but that's really the lens that DCF comes to on this issue.
Yeah, talk about the difficulty in getting good data on this issue because, you know, we mentioned it's underreported and people who experience themselves may not even realize that it's something that happened to them. So talk about how you go about getting this data and the challenges involved with that.
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest things too is kind of the awareness both on folks who may be reporting or observing trafficking and then educating this issue. So victims and survivors themselves are aware of what's happened to them. DOJ has done some great work training law enforcement across the state. DCF has trained child welfare workers, so they are equipped to identify this issue when children might be coming into our child welfare system. And that's now one of the places where it has to be reported due to change in statute a few years ago. Educators are getting kind of trained up on this. But if people don't know what to look for, they won't know how to report it. And often, because traffickers prey on the most vulnerable, it's kind of really dependent on this need for human connection. And when you don't have human connection, those youth are often super vulnerable to trafficking. So they may not realize something is being done to them. They feel that this is a trusted person who is providing them love, support, and attention that they might not be getting in kind of other parts of their life. So they don't identify as a victim. And that's why it's often also so hard for law enforcement and social workers and so important for them to be equipped with the right training to have this trauma-informed and victim-centered approach to have these conversations to really suss out what happened.
We're talking right now with Danielle Melfi. She's the Assistant Secretary for the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families, and we're talking about the issue of human trafficking in Wisconsin. And Danielle, let's talk about some of the signs. It sounds like it just takes one person to make a difference here to flag an instance of potential trafficking. You mentioned the role of educators, law enforcement, people like that, but really anyone might be able to see the signs of human trafficking. So what are some of the telltale signs that people should be on the lookout for?
Yeah. So a few different categories of things. So abnormal behavior. If a child has a kind of a significant change in behavior, hanging out with a new group of people, might be kind of on more online and increased virtual presence. One of the big trends we're seeing is how sex trafficking is moving online in so many ways, how kids are using all the different apps to talk to their friends, to play games. That's often kind of a prime way for traffickers to prey on younger victims. If a child appears that they're kind of uncertain in answering questions, so you might ask them a question of, oh, how old are you? Where are you from? Where are you going? And if that child is kind of looking to the folks around them and giving confusing stories, that might be an indication that something is wrong. If a child has an appearance that doesn't fit with what you know about them, so if they're a runaway or homeless youth, but they have extra cell phones, might be prepaid debit cards, that may be an indication. But I think the challenge is you don't often know what trafficking looks like. So it is kind of paying attention to these different signs. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has a great resource on their website detailing a whole bunch more of different signs to look for, as well as ways to report.
Let's talk about the role that state government plays. There are already policies in place here in Wisconsin aimed at reducing human trafficking. It sounds like there might be more legislative efforts in the work. What is state government's role in preventing this from happening here in Wisconsin?
Yeah. So the role, especially of the Department of Children and Families, really exists in kind of that prevention and education training component. So DCF has developed training for all child welfare professionals across the state. It's a required training. So for social workers who are dealing with some of our most vulnerable populations, they're equipped to know kind of what's happening and what to see. DCF has also worked with the Department of Justice and the Wisconsin Hotel and Lodging Association to develop a webinar series for staff in the hotel industry, as workers are often kind of the eyes and ears and will be the first folks to see if there's something suspicious going on. We've also done some work with the Department of Public Instruction. There's a curriculum now available on their website that's provided and kind of encouraged for educators of if they want to learn more, if they want to figure out how to talk to kids about this issue, here's a way for them to do that.
And I don't know if it was DCF that was doing this or another group, but I read something about reaching out to truck drivers, because truck drivers, too, can be a great, they might be a good choice, like you said, with hotel workers and identifying this. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so there's actually an organization called Truckers Against Trafficking, who does a lot of work in this space. They have a really strong partnership with the federal Department of Homeland Security, working on this issue for many years now. And law enforcement in Wisconsin, I believe, has been engaged in that. And there also has been some legislation moving kind of specifically around education for truckers and what we're doing at that intersection.
Is part of the issue here that, as legislation continues to build and we try to, prevent ways, new ways, you talked about how in the digital space, traffickers are using that to find victims. And with anything like this, the technology is always two steps in front of everyone. So is that part of the challenge, the policies trying to catch up to where the traffickers actually are?
100%. And I think it is such a multifaceted issue. So it's when we think of, okay, there's this kind of awareness, educating people on the issue. It is helping victims and supporting survivors. But I think we really like to think of it as pipeline in and pipeline out. What are those broader systemic issues that make youth and individuals more vulnerable? And on the other side, how are we better supporting these folks who are coming out of a trafficking situation to get back on their feet? What is the job training and resources? What are the housing resources? There's a bill that's been moving through the legislature, a safe harbor bill, which prohibits charging a minor with the crime of prostitution, recognizing that they're a victim and not a perpetrator. And that's another piece of the puzzle as well.
And what role do you see survivors having in speaking out and really trying to raise awareness about this issue? I mean, certainly there's a balance to be struck between having people relive traumatic events, but also, someone who's been a survivor can also be a powerful voice in raising awareness on this issue. How do you strike that balance?
Totally. And you can't make any meaningful policy or program change without centering the people who that is intended to serve. So DCF has actually worked on a documentary called It Happens Here, which will be released next year and actually features survivors here in Wisconsin and sharing their stories. But it's really how is that built on trust? How are we making sure that is kind of a mutual relationship? And how are we supporting survivors through that process of telling their story? It's not telling it to tell it. It's telling it to make a meaningful difference in and helping to serve others so they don't experience that situation that they did.
As we begin to wrap up, could you share a success story that you've seen in your work of, a situation where, prevention really worked, or a survivor really, coming back strong, or just something that you've seen in your work that was really just a strong story that stuck with you, months and years later?
Yeah, so I think there's been some really powerful work, especially in the Milwaukee area. So there's the Human Trafficking Task Force of Greater Milwaukee that has done some really great work to mobilize activists at different facets of this issue, bringing them together, working on meaningful policy changes, and elevating the voices of survivors in that conversation. And I think that's a mechanism for us to model across the state and statewide as well.
And you said this documentary is coming out later this year. When can we expect to see this? Do you know?
Yeah, so we're hoping to roll it out early next year and working currently with the Department of Public Instruction to develop a curriculum to go along with that. So we're providing people with this information, but also kind of educating of how do we talk about it and where do you go from here now that you've seen it.
Sure. And briefly, if people want more information about human trafficking or need resources, where can they find them?
They can head to the Department of Children and Families website, as well as the Wisconsin Department of Justice has some great resources as well.
Danielle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Danielle Melfi is the Assistant Secretary for the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families, and she joined us to talk today about human trafficking here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, we'll talk about what's driving the decline of taverns in rural parts of Wisconsin with a closer look at what the trend looks like in Marshfield.
Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up, former special counsel Robert Mueller has agreed to testify publicly in front of Congress next month. We'll talk with a political reporter about what lawmakers are hoping to gain from the hearings.
Right now, if it seems like you've seen fewer taverns across the state, it turns out you might be onto something.
According to the state's Tavern League, Wisconsin has lost thousands of its taverns since the 1990s.
Our next guest recently explored how this trend is playing out in rural parts of the state and spent some time looking at the decline of taverns in Marshfield.
Ryan Weichelt is an associate professor of geography at UW-Eau Claire. His recent piece for WisConText is titled "The Bygone Era of Marshfield's Rural Taverns." He spoke with Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez.
Well, I want to start with the numbers. What have we seen in terms of how many rural taverns we've lost across the state?
Well, the best numbers I could find were from the Tavern League of Wisconsin. And in an article they had written in the mid-1990s, there were about 15,000 taverns in Wisconsin. And by 2016, that number has dropped to nearly 11,000 across the state.
And you look specifically at what this trend has looked like in Marshfield. And it sounds like you saw that kind of on the local level, too, right?
Yeah, that place, the reason I picked Marshfield was a place I grew up, and I remember seeing these taverns dotting across the landscape. I was kind of a little too young, but I remember my brother and sister would go up the road to one of the local taverns to get candy. It was the only place they could go. So I sort of noticed the derelict landscape as we're kind of driving around visiting family members, and kind of popped in my head what the heck was going on.
And it wasn't always taverns in Marshfield. In the early days, it sounds like there were grain mills. And these grain mills were kind of in part working grain mill, in part local bar.
Yeah, I mean, Marshfield sort of developed, the city itself developed with manufacturing and really took off with the advent of the railroad going through the central part of the state known as the Hub City. But the other industry that was around that was mainly German background that were farmers. And as time had gone on, these grain mills had sort of developed for the farmers to take their products. And eventually, there would be a bar attached to it. My grandpa telling me stories about when he'd take that stuff up and they'd have a beer, and that's how he got to talk to a lot of people.
Yeah, and then fast forward to the end of the 1900s, and you say close to 3/4 of those were closed. We'll dig a little bit deeper into the specifics, but broadly, what led to all the closures of these taverns?
Yeah, I think just in terms of talking, it was fun research product. It was really difficult to find specific information about that, so I just went right to the source. Former tavern owners and older persons sitting around some of the bars were some of the best information I could find, and they were telling me from the 1960s, 70s, and it really increased in the 1980s and 1990s. Were the decline of these taverns in the rural areas, and much of the information they talked about were the increase in costs. And two other big things were when Wisconsin changed its drinking age from, and went from 18 to 19 and then 21 in 1988. That hurt a lot of people going into these places. And at that same time, changes in, as time went on with drunk driving laws really started impacting some of these rural taverns. Wasn't as easy for people to drive back and forth as they hadn't in the past.
Right. And you get into a couple other specific reasons that could account for this trend. One of them being the changes in the agriculture industry in the area. Can you walk us through that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like I said before, this is a predominantly German area, and dairy farming is the big industry. I know Marshall itself one time had a number of cold storage places and ice cream, cheese factories dotted the landscapes associated with that. By the 1980s and 1990s, specifically with the big boom in economic time in the 1990s, many of the farmers were getting older. They were getting close to retiring. And as the Marshfield Clinic grew, there was a lot more money for people to start moving into the rural landscape. And farmers that were either done farming or going to retire or found that it was too expensive to keep going, a lot of them were selling their land off. And so the farming industry, which is still there, it's just not as prominent as it was in the past, certainly impacted those people that were kind of more connected to the landscape, and they were less likely to go to these rural taverns in lieu of going into town.
And a part of it, too, that you talk about in your piece is the shrinking number of farmhands that were working on these farms. Is that right?
Yeah. As you know, as a lot of these things started closing down, these farmhands, my grandfather himself would have had two or three people that would work his farm and work other types of farms. As those started closing, there just weren't as many farmhands around. And these farmhands typically would go to these local rural taverns to get a drink and talk with other people as well. So those things all kind of combined as a whole of decreasing the agricultural industry in the rural areas. And at the same time, those taverns had to follow suit because they weren't making as much money.
We're talking to Ryan Weichelt of UW-Eau Claire about a piece he wrote looking at the decline of rural taverns in Marshfield. You can find that piece online at wiscondex.org. And Ryan, you also say that urbanization is part of this. How does urbanization play a role?
Yeah, again, as you know, the big change in Marshfield really was the growth of the Marshfield Clinic over time, and a lot of that transitioning from manufacturing and agriculture to more service-based. They had a lot more money, and if you actually look at the population of Marshfield, sort of saw slow increases, and by around 2010, we've actually seen a decrease in the city itself, but an increase in the population in the rural areas as there was more money, desires to build more houses, and that type of stuff. It really started changing the rural landscape as a whole.
You mentioned also tougher drunk driving laws and raising the age, the legal drinking age to 21. That surprised me a little bit. Why did that have an impact on rural taverns?
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, I guess it was, you can make an argument, it was a good thing the drunk driving laws came into effect. We were talking to people, it was pretty common on a weekend for people to go to supper clubs or go to 3, 4, 5 of these bars in one evening out in the rural areas. They just drive from one place to another. I remember my grandparents telling stories about going to different places, doing polka dancing and those types of stuff. It was pretty common to kind of hop from one place to another. So for those particular individuals, when drunk driving laws were, you know, stricter, it was you didn't want to get caught, so therefore you didn't want to drive as much to these different places. And then as the youth started not going to the bars between 18 and 21, when those laws were changed in the late 1980s, people I talked to in Marshfield especially saw a more increase of people coming into Marshfield because it was cooler for the young people to go hang out with other young people than hanging out in these rural places that were generally older people. So
I want to key in on something you said that maybe some people would think that this is a good thing. Maybe the decline of rural taverns reflects a culture that's moving away from alcohol. But you also say that it's not necessarily that people are drinking less, they're just drinking differently, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing. I don't want to say it was a good thing these things all closed down and it was people's livelihoods and stuff like that. But needless to say, we know in the pieces that you've been running, it certainly illustrates alcohol is an important part of Wisconsin culture and continues to play a role in Wisconsin's history. I have talked to some of the rural purveyors that are still working, and someone emailed me pretty close saying we're doing really well. I just want to let you know there's still places to go in the rural areas. But I know as these things have decreased, people have decided in these communities that are developing in these subdivisions, those themselves become sort of these local watering holes that, you know, people bring beer and hang out in people's basements and watch the Packer games and do all the other fun type of stuff. So it's kind of an interesting trend that has taken place.
And you mentioned, obviously, this was certain people's livelihoods. I wonder what else you think we lose when we lose rural taverns.
I mean, you do kind of leave those that have experience, and many Wisconsinites can certainly attribute to this. You sort of lose a piece of that history, that connection. Specifically, you know, this is before social media. This is the one way that a lot of people said how they got to know what their neighbors were doing. You know, it's personal connections and stories, talking to farmers, understanding what the conditions are in different places. You kind of lose that sense of community. And I think a lot of the rural areas across the United States have certainly felt that impact of, you know, kind of losing attachment to the land itself, in lieu of sort of new modern types of techniques. So the rural landscape maybe isn't as connected as it maybe had been in the past. And I think these taverns played an important role of connecting people in those areas.
Do we know if this trend of less and less rural taverns, does it continue today?
I'm not going to lie. I haven't really looked at many other places across the state of Wisconsin, but having driven across many different things and doing other types of research, they just don't seem to be as popular as they had in the past. And I think you can pretty much, most people would probably agree there's less rural taverns than there were in the past and many other places.
Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you so much.
That was Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez speaking with Ryan Weichelt of UW-Eau Claire about the decline of rural taverns in the Marshfield area. You can find Ryan's article online at wiscontext.org.
Coming up after the news, former special counsel Robert Mueller will testify in front of Congress next month. We'll look ahead to what Democrats and Republicans are hoping to gain. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up with lawmakers voting on the state budget, we'll take a closer look at the history of the governor's partial veto powers in Wisconsin.
First, it's time for our weekly look at the top news in national politics.
The House passed a bill aimed at funding operations at the U.S.-Mexico border after a week of reports detailing poor conditions at migrant detention facilities. The first round of Democratic presidential debates kicks off tonight, and former special counsel Robert Mueller will testify in front of Congress next month.
Our question for you this week is, what are you curious to hear from Robert Mueller in his public testimony? What do you want lawmakers to ask? Do you think it's still worth having the private counsel testify in front of Congress about his reports? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org.
Ginger Gibson is a political correspondent for Reuters. Ginger, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
So let's first take a look at the border aid bill. This is a $4.5 billion bill that was passed in the House yesterday. Can you break down what this money is intended for?
That's right. This was funding that has been passed through the House and now through the Senate in order to provide aid for the southern border. So this would be everything from some security along the wall, along the border, as well as the facilities that are being used to house migrants. It is a spending measure that provides more for migrants and less of the enforcement funding that the administration had asked for, which is something that Republicans are not so happy about, and really neither are Democrats at this point.
And the House passed the bill yesterday, as we just said. Let's take a quick listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi speaking before the vote.
Today, our legislation is a vote against the cruel attitude toward children of this administration. This bill does not fund the administration's failed mass detention policy. Instead, it funds effective, humane alternatives to detention that have a proven record of success. It secures, this legislation secures, limits on how the money is spent and how the administration treats children.
Can you break down some of what the limits Pelosi is mentioning are?
That's right. Pelosi doesn't want the money to be used to pay for these facilities that are housing children. We've seen horrific accounts of what conditions these children are being held in, places where the lights are on all day, 24 hours, that are dirty, children who are sick and not being tended to, children in very bad health. Instead, Pelosi wants these children reunified with their parents or other family members, responsible adults who are in the United States, wants a system that's able to process these people. And that also means releasing their parents or responsible adults from detention centers where adults are being housed. It's meant to try to up the reunifications instead of continuing to fund these detention facilities.
And correct me if I'm wrong, there's also some caveats in the bill as we have it now that could limit contracts with these facilities if they don't get, these facilities in working order within a certain time frame. Is that correct?
That's right. They want to put pressure on the administration because they're using contractors. So these aren't government facilities. These are private, essentially private operated facilities by private companies who are operating with contracts with the U.S. government. They want pressure on them to improve the conditions, to make them something that doesn't look like a children's prison, essentially, and to care for these children that there's no other way to reunify them.
Pelosi had to do some negotiating with the progressive wing of her own party to make sure that this bill would pass. What were some of the demands that she was encountering during this process?
That's right. Democrats in her party, particularly the more liberal part of her party, wanted her to put more of their demands on there. Everything from sort of defunding ICE, the Customs Enforcement, the folks who are out rounding up people or have threatened to go out and round up migrants who are at risk of deportation, and more measures to sort of scale back some of those efforts, as well as efforts to keep President Trump from building a wall on the southern border, a measure that he has tried to circumvent Congress by using emergency declarations and emergency funds. A lot of these things were difficult to do. Without funding getting passed, they were at risk of having other problems. And Pelosi urged the more liberal parts of her party to sort of make their demands ones that she thought could be reconciled. With the Senate passing the bill, we know that the Speaker called the President today. They had a 15-minute conversation, according to senior Democratic sources, and that was done to try to urge them to find some way. I mean, it's important to remember the Speaker is a pragmatist. She knows she has to get something done, and it might not please the most liberal parts of her party, but she's got to get it signed off, as she did and will, for a compromise out of the Senate and by the President.
Which Democrats specifically voted against the bill? Because it wasn't really a slam dunk for Pelosi.
It wasn't, and I wish I could give you a list, but I don't have that at my fingertips to give you the names of the Democrats who voted against it. But it wasn't a slam dunk. I mean, Pelosi is an expert at getting bills through. She got almost no Republican support. There was an aggressive effort to whip this legislation and ensure that they did have the votes before moving forward. And because they're going to have to come up with a compromise bill between the House and the Senate and something that the president will sign, she'll have to do this again. So she'll be operating in very thin margins.
Now, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, has had his own opinions on this bill. The Senate has its own emergency border aid bill. And as you just mentioned, you know, we're going to be going through this again with Speaker Pelosi. How do you think that this might shake out in Congress?
You know, this is the House and the Senate, having passed different versions of the bill, are going to have to decide if they're going to reconcile the legislation. It's a formal process that has them sort of sit down and iron out and come to a compromise bill. They also are looking at a vacation next week, recess. They don't like to use the word vacation, but they're not in town next week. So there's a big question as whether or not they can get some type of compromise struck by the end of the week, or they'll all head home on Friday without having reached that resolution.
So we'll be watching in the next, not this upcoming week, but certainly following for an update on this. We are talking to Ginger Gibson right now. She's the political correspondent for Reuters, and she's with us to talk about the biggest news in national politics. Now, yesterday, sort of sticking in this same vein, John Sanders, the acting commissioner of the Customs and Border Patrol Agency, resigned. Why is he leaving his post?
He announced that he was leaving his post, and this comes at a very tumultuous time for his agency. As we talked about, lots of criticism of his organization that the way that these children are being treated at the border. And this is really a moment that has been a lot of crisis. The president has said that he is not happy with these conditions, although his parting message to those in his agency was that he thought that he had done everything he could to, quote, unequivocally say that he helped support the amazing men and women of the agency. He was in an acting role. He had not been approved in this role. And this is really another example of folks in this Trump administration who are put into these acting roles and don't stick around long enough before there's some type of controversy or issue or clash with the White House that they then leave.
Yeah, that seems to have been a pretty consistent thing throughout the last 2 years, that we do see people in these roles and acting ways and then having to move out. And can you talk a little bit about Mark Morgan, who will likely be the person, he's been sort of tapped to become the next acting commissioner of CBP?
That's right. Mark Morgan will now replace the interim, another interim for an interim, at least for the time being. And so really increasing sort of the disarray that we see going on inside this agency, an agency that the president had been really critical of coming in. And so we know that Mark Morgan is taking over and will be the acting commissioner of the agency going forward.
Mark Morgan worked with the Obama administration previously. He's been a big proponent of the Trump administration. How might he work with this current Congress, given his long background at the border?
That's right. Because he has been in this agency for a while, because he's been involved in Washington for a good amount of time, there is at least maybe some hope that he will be able to make some outreach to Democrats on the Hill, that he'll be able to bring some people into maybe some more moderate measures, or at least to calm some of the very vocal criticism that we've seen of the president coming out of the Hill. This is going to be a very difficult task for anyone who would be going forward. The Democrats have been quite critical of the president and his immigration policies, and it would be quite hard to find anyone that would be able to quell those.
We're talking with Ginger Gibson, political correspondent for Reuters, about this week's national political news.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. We're going to be talking about special counsel Robert Mueller planning to testify in front of Congress next month, and we're looking for your thoughts. What will you be watching for? Do you think his testimony about the Russia investigation is important to hear, or is it retreading old ground? What do you want lawmakers to ask Mueller? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org.
We'll continue this conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Ginger Gibson, political correspondent at Reuters. And we're talking about the latest political news in the U.S. Now, right before the break, we started talking about the fact that former special counsel Robert Mueller has agreed to honor a congressional subpoena and testify in front of the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees on July 17th, even though he previously said he doesn't want to speak publicly about the two-year investigation at all anymore. Why did these committees decide to issue this subpoena?
These committees have been weighing for a long time how to handle Mueller and how to move forward with trying to get him to come before their committees to answer questions. Many felt that the report, while voluminous and long and including lots of detail, was short on conclusions from those details. And they wanted to hear Mueller explain either what conclusions weren't included in the report or some reason for not giving those conclusions. They tried to negotiate. They tried to come up with some way to avoid a subpoena. They moved forward with the subpoena, likely because they knew that Mueller would abide by a subpoena. He's a private citizen. There is no executive privilege. There is no grounds, it would seem, for him to avoid a subpoena. So it's sort of one of those like, oh, I throw my hands up. I'm going to do what you want me to do now that you've made me do it.
You know, Mueller isn't one to stray from the script. He basically said, I'll talk about the report. It's about 400 pages, but that's about it. Given that, what are Democrats hoping to gain from having him testify?
Most people haven't read the report. I've read all 400 pages of the report.
Wow.
Probably a handful of your listeners have read all 400 pages of the report, but most people haven't. And so what they really want is to have a moment where there are cameras on and there are lights and there are people paying attention, where everyone who didn't read 400 pages of the report can hear someone explain it in a soundbite that might be able to be replayed over and over again on the news or in a maybe political ad when the president's running for re-election next year.
So there's some long game, it sounds like, with this that we can speculate about, but we're not entirely sure. We had a caller call in. Dave in Lancaster had this to say. The investigation wrapped up shortly after William Barr became attorney general. Can someone in Congress ask whether Mueller was pressured to put out his report then? Is there some speculation to that end?
There's been speculation to that. Those of us in Washington suspect that he had been wrapping up. He was determined to move very quickly. If we look at previous special investigations, he moved faster than most, if not all of them, had in the past, especially given how many witnesses he interviewed. But I have no doubt your listener will find that that question gets asked by someone during his testimony. There has been lots of speculation about that. And that might be something that Mueller is willing to put to bed one way or another, since it's a little bit more of an operational question, even if it's outside the scope of what's actually inside the report.
So the two representatives that wanted to ultimately did subpoena Robert Mueller. We have Adam Schiff and Gerald Nadler. These are both Democrats on two committees. Those are the Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committee. They, you know, both of these committees are bipartisan. What can we expect to hear from Republicans once he testifies?
That's right. These are bipartisan committees. There will be almost as many Republicans asking questions of Mueller as there are Democrats. We've seen Republicans take a couple of different tacks. During the Michael Cohen testimony, there was just an effort to impeach and sort of badmouth Cohen to try to better help the president. I would expect Republicans to try that as well, undermine the things that Robert Mueller has said. And they may also try, we've seen a line of criticism from Republicans that Mueller's investigation never should have happened, that the FBI never should have begun looking into the Trump campaign. And I think we're going to hear a lot of that from Republicans, trying to get Mueller to say something that they think will justify that criticism for them.
There are about 80 House members that currently back the idea of impeachment. Impeachment has been something that's been dogging this investigation for the last 2 years. We've talked about the pragmatist Speaker Pelosi. She is not one of them. Do you think that this testimony could ultimately put more pressure on her to get behind proceedings?
I would say that we are unlikely to see Nancy Pelosi move forward with any type of impeachment proceedings unless she thinks she has the votes to impeach the president. She's a vote counter. At her very core, she's someone who pays attention to how many votes she has. And for her, the political calculation is that if she starts impeachment proceedings and she can't win them, the president will say that he has been vindicated, that it has been proven now that he did nothing wrong. And she's concerned, from what I understand, talking to people who are close to her, that will help the president. It will help the president get reelected. It will hurt Democrats' credibility. And so I think it's going to take a whole lot more than just Robert Mueller testifying to get Pelosi to move forward. It's going to take a big change in public opinion and the opinion inside the Congress.
As we wrap up, some more pressing political news. Over the next two nights, 20 of the Democratic candidates will be taking part in the first debate of the 2020 presidential campaign. They've been randomly divided into two groups of 10. You're going to actually be in the debate hall. Who do you think could benefit most from being where they ended up in the drawing?
That's right. I am speaking to you from sunny 100-degree Miami. It is warm here. There's lots of air conditioning, thank goodness.
Thank goodness, yeah.
I think tonight we're going to see Elizabeth Warren really have the best debate draw. This is an opportunity for her. She's one of the only front runners, top five on the debate stage on tonight's half. And if she can sort of shine tonight, she could end up with the most advantageous draw of all of them.
And can you give us a quick overview about how the candidates actually qualified to be in these debates? Because there are 23 people who are actually in the running.
There are now 25.
25,
we've
okay.
One this week. They just don't stop coming. Joe Sestak, the former senator from Pennsylvania, announced he's running this week. Candidates had to get 65,000 individual donors to contribute to their campaign or had reached 1% in three polls. So 20 of them qualified. There was a sitting governor, the governor of Montana, who did not qualify. So it was a little tough for some of them to get onto the stage. The next debate, it is sort of the same type of qualifications. However, when they return to the debate stage in September, they will have to have doubled both of those qualifications. So it's going to get harder from here on out.
No one person is going to have a lot of time to talk, given how big these two debates are. How do you expect to see candidates try to stand out?
Candidates will try to stand out by fighting with other candidates. If you only get a minute to answer your questions, you can get another minute if somebody criticizes you, and then you get an opportunity to respond. So that's one way. The other way is to have really pre-rehearsed answers, to know what you want to say in that minute. And when I talk to strategists, they say the best way to get some extra time is to not complain about how little time that you have. That wastes the precious little minutes that are there.
In the last minute that we have, can you give us a very brief overview of the next White House press secretary?
That's right. I'm going to do my best to imitate a presidential candidate and give you a minute answer. Stephanie Grisham is coming to the White House to be the White House press secretary. She was previously the spokeswoman for Melania Trump. Before that, worked for President Trump's 2016 campaign. A bit more combative, maybe, than her predecessor, although her predecessor was plenty combative as well. But we'll be taking the helm, and we'll be seeing a lot more of Stephanie and how maybe she does or doesn't change the relationship that the White House press corps has with the administration.
Ginger, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ginger Gibson is a political correspondent for Reuters. She was with us for our weekly look at this week's news out of Washington, D.C. And stay with us later on in the show. We will be talking more about the political debates that begin tonight and carry over into tomorrow. And you'll have your chance to chime in on that conversation as well. And you can join us at Central Time WPR if you want to give us your thoughts on the Robert Mueller testimony that is coming up in a little under a month in Washington, D.C.
Police in Grand Chute, Wisconsin, are on the lookout for a roaming animal. Only instead of it being a lost cat or a lost dog, it's something, well, maybe a bit more exotic.
Earlier this week, a 911 caller reported spotting a kangaroo, yes, a kangaroo, hopping across a bridge over Interstate 41. While there have been no signs of the kangaroo since, Grand Chute police officers have been looking into it and appear to be having some fun with the whole thing, tweeting out silly photos as they go.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. A picture of a Grand Chute police officer. He's holding a net and he's holding a cat carrier. So, like, that's going to, you know, contain the mysterious kangaroo that may or may not exist.
Oh, yeah. I imagine that that's a really spot on way to control a really strong animal. They can, like, really take you out if they kick you or knock you down with their tails.
You know, I love these stories. It reminds me of a couple years ago when there was a report of a lion being in Milwaukee, and then you know, people had some fun with it. There was the one sighting, and then, you know, people started calling in being like, I think I saw the lion, and it turns out it was just kind of like a large house cat or something. But really, just like the social media, the fun that people had with it, where, and, you know, agencies got in on it too, where, you know, I think Milwaukee Transit photoshopped a picture of a lion riding a city bus. So I'm curious to see if anything is going to come out of this. So if you have any good kangaroo memes that you want to send our way, tweet them at us at Central Time WPR. We love memes.
We'll take them. We want to see them. If you spot it, give us a heads up. Yeah. We'd love to see your spotted kangaroo sightings. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.